died of during the starvation, as well as during the transportation to Siberia. They developed the concept of red fascism, of social fascism. The only way that the regime could stabilize itself in the Soviet Union was by carrying on a civil war inside the country. And that's what they carried on, against the peasantry on the countryside to collectivize the land because of the terrible threat that the peasants had made against the government, against the cities by withholding their grain. And they carried on a terror in the working class, in the factories, by all kinds of stringent laws and regulations. For instance, every Russian worker had to have a passport, an internal passport, the only country in the world where everybody had to have a passport. No other country in the world, not even the fascist Germany developed that. And this was like the land of the rising sun of socialism, whatever you want to call it. Well, this then they developed the theory that the socialists were fascists. They're fake socialists. They aren't socialists. They're really fascists that cover themselves up by using the term socialists. So they are social fascists. And they are worse, they are 10 times worse than Hitlerism, because they're working in the working class. They're befuddling the working class and fooling them. Therefore, it is absolutely impossible to have any kind of collaboration with these social fascists, because they're enemies of the working class and humanity and everything else. Well, you know how this worked out in Germany. How could you carry on a struggle against fascism in Germany, rising tide of Hitlerism, if you had the socialists and the communists flying at each other's throats? The combined votes of these two parties totaled something like 7 million votes, or 13 million votes, I think, 13 million, something like that. And because of the disunity and the distrust between the two of them, Hitlerism marched into power. That was carried on in this country. Norman Thomas was a fascist. Anybody and everybody in the labor movement was a fascist to one degree or another. William Green was the head of the American Federation of Labor in those days, and naturally he was a fascist because he wasn't a member of the Communist Party. Franklin Roosevelt was a fascist. He was a fascist, Franklin Roosevelt, sure. Now don't ask me, well, how come they supported him 2 years later? That's their answer. That's their problem to answer. But that's what they preached. Anybody and everybody was a fascist to one degree or another. The Lovestoneites were fascists, naturally. But the biggest fascist and the most degenerate fascist of all were the mad dog counter-revolutionary Trotskyites. The trade unions were fascist-led. Only a fool would belong to the trade unions, the AFL. Of course, if you belong to one of them and you have to do it because of your livelihood, it's okay to stay in there. But try to break it away from the American Federation of Labor and set up a red trade union. That's what they did in this country. They ran up and down the country trying to build these red trade unions, not fascist unions like the AFL. Well, you know where they got. They got to nowhere. The Communist League of America, of course, had nothing to do with this kind of nonsense. They stirred all their membership into the American Federation of Labor and carried on the struggle inside there. I say the whole super revolutionary program was only a cover up for the wiping out of all the opposition in the Soviet Union. Now, during this period of isolation and the great terrific odds that were against the development of a Trotskyist movement, don't think for a minute that the American Trotskyists were stagnating and going to hell. By no means. This tiny little group, probably by 1933, when I joined, there was probably maybe 250 members. I doubt it. We didn't have 250 members. Well, anyway, this tiny little grouping brought out such publications as these that are classics of Marxism, if anybody wishes to understand anything about the period from 1925 up to 1940. On Germany, three pamphlets were brought out by this little grouping. Germany, the key to the international situation. Germany, what next? And another pamphlet, Germany, the only road. The three classic articles or pamphlets by Trotsky covering the rise of Hitlerism and the advice that he was given to the German workers and to the German Communist Party leadership. totaling probably 400 or 500 pages. Then Spain had a Spanish Revolution broke out in 1930-31, and Trotsky wrote his famous pamphlet on communism versus syndicalism. That was published by this tiny little grouping, pamphlet of probably 120 pages or so. Then alongside of that was a book, 200 pages, on the problems of the Chinese Revolution. The only pamphlet that has been written, the only book that has been written explaining the real meaning of what Soviets are, what their role is in the socialist revolution, so forth. What a united front is, and so forth. All of these books were published by this tiny little group. Then there was several writings on the Soviet Union, on the economic development of the Soviet Union, as well as a history of the left opposition by Max Schachtman, various other pamphlets on the American scene by Americans. All this was accomplished by this tiny little group of individuals who made, individuals in this little grouping who made special contributions to see that these books were published. Now, they weren't published in a regular publishing house, but by the party print shop that we had in those days. Now, I'd like to say just one little word about Spain and unprincipled politics. When the left opposition was expelled throughout the whole world, they were expelled in Spain the same as everywhere else. And the leader of the Spanish left opposition was a man named André Nin, N-I-N. He was a founder of the Spanish Communist Party. He'd been a very close associate of Trotsky at the Communist International in Moscow. Alongside of that was the right opposition that was expelled, led by a man named Juan Morin. Now, the left opposition's main base was among the workers, mainly in Catalonia, Barcelona, and the other cities in that province. The main base of Morin was among the Spanish peasantry. And during the heat of the Spanish Revolution, lo and behold, these two organizations decide to merge. Now, what was the basis of their merger? The left opposition, headed by Nin, denounced Stalinism as a centrist grouping in the Soviet Union that had no program, that was creating a brutal society in the Soviet Union, that was 100% wrong on its present binge of calling the socialists fascists and so forth and so on, that was trying to create red trade unions and everything else. In other words, there was absolutely nothing in common between Nin's and the left opposition and Stalinism. Morin, on the other hand, was a right oppositionist, like Lovestone in this country, and his main theme in life was that Stalin is hunky-dory. It's just that Comrade Stalin doesn't recognize that I could run the Communist Party in Spain better than whoever he put in as the leadership. Now, he had two opposites. One that says Stalin's a scoundrel and one that says Stalin's a pretty good guy and a clever guy on top of that, too. How could they unite? Well, Trotsky intervened naturally. And he tried to point out to Nin the impossibility of uniting water and oil. But his words fell on barren soil. And when they united and formed the POUM, the Party of Marxist Unity, Trotsky wrote his letter, his last letter to Nin, and told Nin that he was signing his death warrant, his political death warrant. And we might say that this unification, more than anything else, contributed to the terrible defeat of the Spanish working class in 1936-39. Because Morin and the right wing was the one that set the pace in the POUM, the PUM. This is a terrible lesson in unprincipled politics, unprincipled combinationism. Two groupings of opposite viewpoints uniting to form an organization that was going to turn out and defeat its own purpose and defeat the Spanish Revolution. Well, comrades, that's as far as we go. I've yakked for an hour and a half. And I try to cover that period up to the taking of power by Hitlerism, so that next week we should be able to go right through the entrance into the Socialist Party and what we get and our expulsion from the Socialist Party and the founding of the Socialist Workers' Party. Now, any comments that haven't got the haven't got the writings of canon on the early history of the American Trotskyist movement should get it, because these talks are based on the writings of Comrade Trotsky, of Comrade Canon. And the history of American Trotskyism is down here on sale. We ordered a whole bunch of extra copies for the comrades that are going to take the classes. They sell for $2. And a comrade should obtain one of them just as quickly as possible. And then also the other history, the Struggle for a Proletarian Party, because that is the companion book on organization on how to build a revolutionary party in this country, not only in this country, but in any other country of the world. Are there any questions, comrades? Yeah, Gary? Well, it's according to the political differences that you have in the party. A man or a woman thinks twice before forming a faction. But it's how deep the differences are between the individual and the party program, or the leadership of the party, and so forth. It's a big responsibility. On the other hand, there's no other way that I know of where you can settle serious political differences. There's no other way. The old man organized the left opposition in the Soviet Union. Well, he was one of the key factors in organizing. So sometimes there is an absolute necessity to organize a faction, or else it's political extinction, and can be the political extinction of the party, unless a faction is organized to save it, as was done in 1940 by Comrade Canon, 1939. Any other question, Jim? Tom?
I've been reading on Labor's giant step, and in there, Price talks about how, at the beginning of the Depression, the Communist Party didn't have any increase in membership at all. And it was only with the coming out of the Depression in the late 1930s that the Communist Party really got big. Could you make this problem for us, describe the reaction of workers to left-wing propaganda in the late 30s?
Yeah, there's no question down about it that the Stalinists did start putting on some flesh and blood in 1929 when the collapse came. But not in the same at the same speed that they did in once they put on people's frontism. See, where were the workers to turn to in 1929? They never heard of the Communist Left Opposition, the CLA, the Communist League of America. And the whole natural tendency was to go to the Communist Party. If you became a radical, you weren't a student of the movement the day you became a radical. Your impulses were what we need in this goddamn country is what they did in Russia, a revolution. Where's those guys that represent that idea? Communist Party. And they went down and joined the Communist Party. It's sad to say that a lot of them went in the front door and out the back door, like Omar Khayyam did. I mean, just as much as he did when he went in. And he listened to the wise men, wasn't it, or something like that? Well, the Communist Party started to put on flesh in the early 30s. They conducted a heroic struggle among the unemployed. They had the admiration, the communist workers had the admiration of every radical, the way they organized the unemployed and the struggles they carried on. Well, as I said, their loyalty to the party was abused by a gang of degenerate leaders that by this time, in the early 30s, Browder and so forth, a real genuine clown for love of Peter as far as a leader was concerned. And as Cannon said, he was living on a mushroom cloud at that period. He didn't know where the hell he was. Now, when the Communist Party made the turn in 1935, January 1935, when they made the turn of people's frontism, that is, the socialists of yesterday are no longer fascists, they're our dear comrades. And the leadership of the American Federation of Labor are no longer fascists, but brilliant militant trade union leaders. I don't know, how could a guy write one thing one day and the next day write the opposite? But that's for them to answer. It's a psychopathic as far as I could see. But when they put on this new line, and then the line of supporting Roosevelt indirectly. They never came out point blank and said, we are for Roosevelt. No, they unloaded on the opponents of Roosevelt. They covered up all the treacheries of Roosevelt. Not the treacheries, they weren't treacheries. They covered up all the double dealing of Roosevelt. like when he put through all kinds of cuts on the unemployed budget and so forth and so on. They didn't blame Roosevelt, they blamed the senator, whoever had charge of the budget that was fighting for this in the Senate, and so on. Now they started to gather thousands and thousands of radical workers because they talked Americanism. They Americanized the Communist Party. They were the real patriots, and their slogan was, the communism is 100%, what the hell is 100%, communism is today's Americanism, or something like that. What was the speech? Yeah, 20th century Americanism. And Browder used to wrap himself up in the American flag and parade around that way. At least it seemed that way. Well, they gathered in the workers by the tens of thousands. No question down about it. They gathered them in by the tens and tens of thousands. And the workers joined this organization to lock horns with capitalism. And they found out that they stayed a year, maybe. And instead of locking horns with capitalism, they were told to get out the vote for Roosevelt. Not get it out, but get out the vote against Joe Palooka, who's running against Roosevelt. What else does that mean? It means getting the vote out for Roosevelt. And then the terrible trade union line of class collaboration with the most outrageous class collaborators in the trade union field also disillusioned thousands and thousands of these revolutionary workers that were looking for an answer to their problems. The unemployed workers that joined the party weren't hoodwinked by this propaganda that they put out, that it was the senators and so forth that were cutting the appropriations for the unemployed. They knew that Roosevelt was a boy, and they quit the party. So the result was that no question down about it, that in this period, the communists, there must have been hundreds of thousands of workers joined the Communist Party. Hundreds of thousands went in one door and out the other, say from 1935 to the outbreak of war. I remember I had a friend of mine, fellow I went to high school, to grammar school with. And lo and behold, geez, we met one day and he's yakking like hell out of the left side of his mouth. A nice guy. And I found out he got pretty good. The communist, pretty good guy. And so I'm going to join them. But I told him what I was and I tried to talk reason to him. I couldn't do it. Well, I met him, he joined the CP. And I met him a couple of years later and he'd already gone through the mill. So I said to him, well, listen, Pat, I told you, for Christ's sake. It's just like the goddamn Catholic Church that we were brought up in. And he said, I know it, yeah, the son of a bitch, just the same. Christ, no discussion, nobody knew what the hell was going on. The orders came down. I said, well, you have to take the bull by the horns now. I told you that what it was, and I was right. He said, Christ's sake, they're all the same. See what I mean? Workers went in the Communist Party, and you couldn't talk to them afterwards. They were so demoralized, and they had no education in the Communist Party, so that when you try to explain to them that we're different, they say, they're all the same. Is that what you mean, Jim? No, just about it. Yeah? Any other questions, comments? Yeah? Oh, wait a second. You got a question here, Sherry?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, why was it that Cannon didn't appeal to the masses?
What masses?
The
great masses. The great masses weren't interested in communism. Communist Party numbered probably, as I said, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 at the most. At the most, 5,000. So there was no masses. He had no way of appealing to the great Communist Party members, rank and file, because the Trotskyists were only located in a dozen cities or so. And on top of that, they had their goon squads looking out for the left oppositionists. And they had these goon squads right up to 1939. When they suddenly discovered that Hitler wasn't the man that caused all the war, it was Roosevelt and Churchill. Hitler wants to make peace. That's what they published in their paper. While Comrade Stalin and Comrade Hitler were pals. Yeah?
One of the examples you mentioned at Trotsky, he asked the question about what happened to the communists and the Jews when they came to power. Were they imprisoned, slaughtered?
Oh, they were slaughtered. They were just slaughtered, sure. These books were written before Hitler took power, explaining the great danger that was coming. He described Hitler to the communist movement as a super Rangel. Rangel, or whatever his name was, W-R-A-N-G-E-L, was a leader of the White Guard armies in the intervention against the Socialist Revolution in Russia in 1918 or 19. And Trotsky said that Hitler will be the leader of the counter-revolution against the USSR if he comes to power, and that the world capitalists would rally around him and help him. And when Hitler did take power, that's exactly what he turned out to be. Yeah, Sean?
How is it that, in the 20s, most In most countries, the Communist Party became the, like in Germany and France, became, the large working class party. How is it that it didn't happen this way in America? I mean, is it because America was just the most prosperous country? Or?
There was never any real socialist mass movement in this country. Never was. The Socialist Party never amounted to a row of pins in this country. The biggest vote Debs got was 900,000 votes for president. And there's no question at all about it that 75-80% of that 900,000 were nothing but liberals that voted for him. The hangover of the populist movement. There was no real socialist movement in this country. Among the masses, never was, John. Never was. So that the party here never amounted to a row of pins. Is that what you mean? See, in Europe, what the hell, the Socialist Party, the working class in France, working class in Germany, were organized by the socialists. They were the ones that organized the trade unions in Germany and in France and in Italy. In the United States, the trade unions were organized by themselves, you might say. Individual socialists here and there, but the socialists didn't amount to a row of pins. They had no kind of a mass membership that they could organize trade unions. Hell no. No?
It's a duty of every comrade to read and study the works of a movement. But is that any guarantee that you can't go off the beam somewhere? Like Shatner is very well read, but he began the rule.
No, see, the power of rationalization is endless. I can rationalize myself into the idea that I'm Lenin and end up in the hospital. Shachtman, there were certain characteristics of Shachtman that sort of foretold that where this guy would end. He had a lot on the ball, a very able man, good speaker, good journalist, terrific energy. He had everything to make a good revolutionary. All he lacked was character, that's all. He had no character. His word wasn't worth the powder to blow it to hell. Felix Morrow, another man, excellent journalist, even superior to Shachtman, in my opinion. A lot of energy. He had no character, that's all. I lived with Morrow for 3 months. I know Morrow inside out. He'd take the last dime you had in your pocket and think nothing of it. Son of a bitch, he might have a $10 bill in his own pocket. But if he thought you had a dime, he'd connive one way or another to get that dime from you. He was a miserable son. Yeah, I knew him inside out. See, there's no guarantees. Then, of course, there's class forces in society that force every individual one way or the other. And you can't tell when an individual is going to capitulate, cave in, and so forth. Why did, out of all the hundreds and thousands of members that have joined the Trotskyist movement in this country, what has become of them? Well, various reasons. They go and stand on the sidelines. Some people can take it for 1 year, some people can take it for 5 years. There's various reasons why they can't take it. Some people worry what the neighbors next door think about them. Some people worry about what their mother and father is going to think about them, and what their sisters, and for Christ's sake, think they're going to live forever. Yeah? Another question, comrades? Yeah?
Larry, one of the questions evidently that the Russians decided for the World Workers' Movement in this country was our attitude on the Negro question. Isn't that true as far as making some kind of a break from the policy of the old Socialist Party on this?
Yeah, see, the question of the Afro-American rights in this country were never discussed or taken seriously in any of the socialist movements of the country previous to the rise of the Communist International, except the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. They had it in their preamble that this party is open to everybody of race, creed, color, any other goddamn thing. Anybody that doesn't like capitalism, just join here and help us overthrow it. That was the main, that was the sum and substance of the UAW preamble, the IWW. And they were the first ones that gave any consideration to the blacks in this country. In fact, at the Chicago trial of 110 IWW members, because of their anti-war position in 1917. There was only, out of 110, there was one of them that was a black man. And going out, they all got anywhere from 5, 10, 15, and 20 years sentences. On different charges, you add it all up, some of them had sentences of about 80 years. And they weren't concurrent. So when they're going out of the courthouse, this Afro-American fellow makes a wise crack to one of the other members of the IWW and says, well, anyway, I furnished the color for the trial. And the court officer overheard him and reported it to Landis, who was the judge. They brought him back, and the guy had something like 10 years sentence, and Landis just upped it up another 10, gave him 20 years for making the remark. Well, anyway, the Socialist Party was anti-black, as I pointed out. In the South, they had segregated locals. That's a real Socialist Party, boy, oh boy. And it wasn't until the Communist International came about, and the Communist Party was founded in this country, that the Negro question was put on the agenda, and it was put on not by the American communists, but by Lenin. Lenin was the one that raised the question of the rights of the minorities in the United States. And from that time to this, serious thought has been given by the radical movement. When I say the radical movement, I mean the communist movement, not the Socialist Party. But the radical movement, the Trotskyists and the Communist Party, as to how to awaken the Afro-American people in this country to the call for a socialist economy, which would do away with all this Jim Crowism and all kinds of limiting of rights, so forth. Any other questions, comments? Well, let's adjourn and continue next week, all right?